Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest member of the team of grifters who make up Trump's cabinet to have their seedy background exposed, this time Alexandra Acosta, the Secretary of Labor, who made a sweetheart deal with a billionaire money manager, Jeffrey Epstein, a serial child molester and sex trafficker, to escape justice while Epstein's powerful friends, Donald Trump, Bill Clinton, and Prince Andrew, and others, were given protection from exposure if they might be co-conspirators by the non-prosecution deal Acosta made with Epstein's lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, and Ken Starr. Marcy Hamilton, professor and senior fellow in the Program for Research on Religion at the University of Pennsylvania and founder of and CEO of Child USA, a think tank dedicated to evidence-based research to prevent child abuse and neglect, and author of Justice Denied, What America Must Do to Protect Its Children, join us. We'll discuss the many cases of rich and powerful men preying on vulnerable and naive young girls who have escaped justice until now, like Epstein and R. Kelly, and others like the owner of the Patriots and the former head of Citigroup, who were swept up in a six-month sex trafficking investigation resulting in 300 arrests in Florida, nearby where Epstein trolled for young girls and to abuse and traffic. Then we'll look into the plot by a Coast Guard Lieutenant Christopher Hassan to assassinate a number of prominent journalists at MSNBC and CNN, along with House Speaker Pelosi, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and most of the Democratic challengers running against Trump in 2020, Senators Harris, Booker, Gillibrand, and Warren, who Hassan described using Trump's racist pejorative as Poker Warren. Chip Belay, an investigative journalist who studies right-wing movements in the United States and is the co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close to Comfort, joins us to discuss the pattern of heavily armed right-wing white supremacists being influenced and enabled by authority figures like President Trump, whose stated enemies happen to be the same as the ones Hassan wanted to kill. Then finally, we'll examine a hidden chapter in our history, which the American people are largely unaware of, but which the Russian people remember only too well. James Carl Nelson, the author of a new book just out, The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia, joins us to discuss the untold story of the 5,000 American soldiers, mostly from Michigan, who fought the Soviet Union's Red Army in the frozen Arctic region of Archangel in northern Russia between 1918 and 1919. And joining us now is Marcy Hamilton, the Robert A. Fox Leadership Program Professor of Practice and Fox Family Pavilion Resident Senior Fellow in the Program for Research on Religion at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the founder and CEO and Academic Director of Child USA at www.childusa.org, a think tank at the University of Pennsylvania dedicated to evidence-based research to prevent child abuse and neglect. Previously was the chair in public law at the Benjamin Cardoza School of Law at Yeshiva University, and she's the author of Justice Denied, What America Must Do to Protect Its Children, and co-author of the textbook Children and the Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marcy Hamilton.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Marcy, and I must say the overwhelming number of stories that we have to deal with now with R. Kelly, now apparently wasn't able to post bail. Revelations in his indictment were just hideous about the abuse of young women. But the story, of course, that's getting a lot of attention is Robert Kraft, the billionaire owner of the Patriots. He was charged on Friday in a six-month-long trafficking investigation in Florida that resulted in about 300 arrests. Also, the former head of the Citigroup was swept up in that operation. And, of course, then the crowning one, if you will, in terms of it being despicable and disgusting, is the story of Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted sex offender, friends with both Donald Trump and Bill Clinton. And he apparently was given a free pass, in a sense, in effect, by the U.S. attorney down in Florida, overseeing his case, who is now the Secretary of Labor, Alexandra Acosta. So just telling you this, you know, reading that writ, if you will, is depressing enough. But you've been working on this for decades, Marcy, on this subject. At least I would imagine at this point there is a silver lining, in as much as there's some serious attention being paid to this scourge of the exploitation of young girls.
Well, yes, and of course, the biggest scandal in the world that is part of this is the priest abuse in the Catholic Church. And so what we have is a culture. We have a global culture that has been willing to permit children to be sexually abused, and powerful men in every arena, whether it was Penn State or it was the church or it is Epstein with the federal prosecutors, these powerful men have been permitted to skate. And it, you know, the cardinal sin in that former mindset was that a wonderfully contributing, powerful man would lose his livelihood, that somehow that was worse than thousands of children being sexually abused. What's promising in this arena right now is that we are now talking about justice for the victims. The victims are now real people. They're persons in this whole debate, and they're not just faceless collateral damage. So I do have a lot of hope, but I have no hope that these institutions will fix themselves. It will be only through legal reform, ending the statute of limitations for child sex abuse, and empowering these victims. That's really the only route to getting out of this complete mess.
And what do you think is the psychological dimension of this depravity? What is it about powerful men wanting to dominate helpless, young, innocent, and naive girls?
Well, you know, over the centuries, children were actually property. And for many of these men, they're still treating them as though they're just property for them to use for their own ends. But in the 20th century, we started to identify children as holding rights against being abused, rights against being denied medical care. So as the civil rights movement for children has increased, what we've seen is that it pushes up against this presumed right of the men to do whatever they choose. And so we're really in a clash of rights, but it's the children's civil rights that are growing and making the difference.
Well, this character, Epstein, is just so prolific in terms of his criminality. It's just extraordinary how much he's gotten away with for decades, and how, for example, he owns the largest private residence in Manhattan. He has a private island in the U.S. Virgin Islands, the Little St. James. He's given a lot of money, of course, to Harvard University, where Alan Dershowitz described him as being brilliant and one of the most pleasant philanthropists. And of course, Dershowitz, along with Ken Starr, were the two prominent attorneys that defended Epstein in the case that was overseen by the now Labor Secretary. And by the way, Marcy, that team defending Epstein attacked and investigated the FBI team that were investigating them, looking for private sexual peccadilloes amongst the agents. But nevertheless, a very, very powerful case was brought. And that's what we're talking about here in terms of the breaking news, is what happened to that case. It just was absolutely fixed in the most flagrant way. So the real question is, we know that, Trump appointed Acosta as the Secretary of Labor. Ironically, the Labor Department overlooks human trafficking. But what's your sense of what the judge basically said here? He didn't throw the case out or reopen the case, but he more or less said that they broke a federal law. The federal judge said Acosta violated the Crime Victims' Rights Act by hiding the non-prosecution agreement for more than 30 girls who had said that Epstein had abused them. Of course, the number is more like 80 to 100. So where do we stand, do you think?
Well, first of all, the judge gave the parties only 15 days to do something about this, which in its own right tells you the urgency of the issue. But it is not that Epstein had either pled. He did not cut a deal with the federal government in the sense of pleading to certain crimes. He did not get convicted. He was not tried. So double jeopardy does not bar trying him at this point. I think this judge could legitimately lift the non-prosecution agreement, dissolve it, and in for all intents and purposes, that's what he did. And then it would be possible for them to recharge Epstein and go forward with now many more victims. And in fact, sorry, for me, what I don't understand is who is sitting on their hands right now with all of the victims that are in statute to criminally charge him, right? I mean, we know we probably have 80, 100. My guess is many, many more victims out there that the federal prosecutors in Miami could be going after right now. Are they? I hope they're investigating it, because the worst they could do is just continue to cover this up.
And again, I'm speaking with Marcy Hamilton, the Robert A. Fox Leadership Program Professor of Practice and the Fox Pavilion Resident Senior Fellow in the Program for Research on Religion at the University of Pennsylvania. She also is the CEO and Academic Director of Child USA, a think tank at the University of Pennsylvania dedicated to evidence-based research to prevent child abuse and neglect. And she's the author of Justice Denied, What America Must Do to Protect Its Children, and co-author of the textbook Children and the Law. Well, President Trump did not indicate that he was really going to, you know, clean up this mess. Arguably, his cabinet is already a team of grifters, but this fellow is particularly the worst. Trump's response on Friday before the press in the Oval Office was, he's a great guy. He's doing a terrific job as Labor Secretary, and this happened a long time ago. And then Trump said that he was going to have a briefing in 2 hours, and he couldn't answer the question until after the briefing. Well, let's hope that the White House press corps stays on him and ask him what happened in that briefing. But at this point, what I see as a possibility is that the cover-up of Bayer Koster of Epstein's crimes, which are manifest, may have something to do with a further cover-up that Epstein's value to his friends was in high places. Was it, one, that he handled their money, and two, that he covered up what went on in his private island and in his various residences, and particularly the one down in Palm Beach in Florida. We know that he was a friend of Bill Clinton's and Donald Trump's. We know that Clinton made a number of trips to this private island, as did Trump. Trump says, I've known Jeff for 15 years. He's a terrific guy. He's lots of fun to be with. It's even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. Now, in 2016, a woman by the name of Katie Johnson sued Trump, saying he had raped her at one of Epstein's parties when she was 13. She later dropped the suit. We don't know why. Do you think that Epstein and Acosta might well be the tip of an iceberg?
Oh, there's no question. He had set up a sex trafficking system in which he got underage girls to supply many underage girls. There's no question more men were involved, his friends, and all over the world. We've heard a few voices of the victims so far, but most of them have been kept quiet. But the reason for that is that the statute of limitations had expired on most of their claims, especially in New York. What will be very interesting is when the New York Child Victims Act, which Governor Cuomo just signed, goes into effect on August 14th, and victims will be able to sue for damages anybody from any year. It will be interesting who names Clinton, who names Epstein, and who names Dershowitz. So we're looking now at the possibility that, once again, opening up the statute of limitations for child sex abuse victims will open the door to finding out what's really been happening. And many of these girls were in New York in his premises, and I would imagine many of them have live claims against both Epstein and other men that they can bring as of August 14th.
Well, of course, the work that you do, Marcy Hamilton, with Child USA at www.childusa.org, think tank dedicated to evidence-based research to prevent child abuse and neglect. What seems to be consistent throughout this is that people just don't believe these young women, particularly these kids from disadvantaged families, single-parent homes. Epstein would recruit one of them and then get her to recruit others, goes trolling the malls and places like that, homeless kids. Some of the girls were so broken by their experience with Epstein. One of them died of a drug overdose. But it's sort of the same profile of the victims in a way that R. Kelly's indictment just over the weekend, where a 14-year-old, they described his assault of a 14-year-old girl. And you recall how long and difficult it was for the young women in the USA gymnastics team to get the authorities to deal with this predator that they had as the team doctor, Larry Nassar. So what is there's a pattern there, and I'm sure you've seen it and have worked against it, but describe it to us. There's two things. One, the girls seem to be very, in Epstein's case, they come from broken homes, sometimes foster children, and then the fact that they don't get believed.
Well, perpetrators that are seeking sex with children are very canny. They're very patient, and they look for the child who does not have a lot of support, and the child that will be the easiest to get alone. And so the poor girls that were brought into the Epstein situation, the fangirls who were overwhelmed by R. Kelly and then just drawn into his whole universe, those are prime examples of how this happens. But the reason that we have so much child sex abuse and then we just don't know about it until later is that on average, it takes victims until age 52 to come forward. And so most victims are not even capable of telling anybody until they're in their adulthood. And if they can't tell anybody, nobody knows about it because these crimes occur in private. Children don't understand what's happening to them. And they're usually threatened. So we're in this scenario now where finally we have an invitation to speak up. We have the Me Too movement, Time's Up. We have kind of a public willingness to listen to the victims, which we've never had before. But what we need is for these victims to be powerful. And the only way for them to be powerful is for us to give them the legal right to charge these individuals and also to sue them. Without those legal rights, it really is just a bunch of stories. That's not enough. That's just not enough. R. Kelly needs to be brought to justice. Epstein needs to be brought to justice. And the same is true just across the board. This is a cultural problem. It's everywhere.
So this federal judge who is sort of reopening the case to some extent, we don't know the extent to which he's given 15 days to the parties, but the 30 girls that Epstein abused, they weren't informed, and that's what the judges, that's what the ruling's about. So will they be informed, and will that open up them to give public testimony?
Well, now they finally are going to be able to be told everything that's happened, and they have a right to know what's happened, and they also have a right to have a say in what the sentencing is or what the plea deal is for someone that abused them. So this the decision by Judge Mara in Florida for the Epstein victims is basically saying not only do they have to be able to have a voice, but they have to be able to talk to the prosecutors who are making the decision about this particular perpetrator. They have to have a say in what happens to him. And these girls, and now women, they never would have agreed to have him get a non-prosecution agreement and be at a county jail by himself, go to work every day, over in 13 months, and the worst that happened to him was he was labeled as a sex offender. Well, he was labeled as a sex offender just in the state of Florida. He didn't care.
Well, just in closing, we have to thank the reporter with the Miami Herald, Julie Brown, who stayed on this story. And I just, as a closing comment, Marcy, we know that Donald Trump wants to overturn the libel laws, he's helped in that regard by the wife of Justice Thomas and Clarence Thomas of the Supreme Court, who also wants to overturn it. And all this will do is hand people like Jeffrey Epstein, Donald Trump, and all these powerful men, the Citigroup guy, Kraft, and whatever, people with money would be able to suppress this very story. This story would not come out under the kind of libel laws that Trump wants.
Well, we need to pass an amendment to every defamation law in every state that says that if someone sues someone who claims they're a victim and it turns out that the victim was telling the truth, that the person that is saying they're a liar has to pay treble damages. They have to pay them triple what they should already owe them. So no one should get away with sex abuse by trying to shut up the victim through a defamation or a libel suit. So the victims' rights movement on that theory of libel law comes right up against what these powerful men are trying to do to shore up their power. They're not going to win. It's just, and the reason they're not going to win is this isn't just the United States. This is a global movement for child sex abuse victims.
Well, Marcy Hamilton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Marcy Hamilton, who's the Robert A. Fox Leadership Program Professor of Practice and the Fox Family Pavilion Resident Senior Fellow in the Program for Research and on Religion at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the founder, CEO, and Academic Director of Child USA at www.childusa.org, a think tank at the University of Pennsylvania dedicated to evidence-based research to prevent child abuse and neglect. Previously, she was the chair in public law at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University, and she's the author of Justice Denied, What America Must Do to Protect Its Children, and the co-author of the textbook Children and the Law. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the would-be assassin's enemies list that happens to be largely the same as Donald Trump's enemies list. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Chip Belay, an investigative journalist who studies right-wing movements in the United States, including the religious right, white supremacist, homophobic groups, and paramilitary organizations. And he also studies the spread of conspiracy theories in the media and on the internet and political cults on both the right and the left of the political spectrum. He's the co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, and editor of Eyes Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chip Belay.
Thank you.
And a few days ago, a Coast Guard officer who drew up a list of top Democrats and TV network journalists for assassination. He had been stockpiling weapons, and we're not sure of how the this inquiry came about and this investigation, which is surprising that the Justice Department really downplayed it, making some people think that had this guy not been a white, middle-aged conservative American, had he been a Muslim or a Mexican, they may have well blown this up into a huge case of domestic terrorism. But that is the only way to describe this extraordinary and mercifully prevented attack by this person. Is there a pattern here that you've detected, Chip Burleigh, since you've been studying this issue for a long time?
There is a pattern. The problem is that there is a long history of how this works, stemming from the studies of fascism in World War II, coming out of groups like the American Jewish Committee and a whole range of scholars. And this has been shoved aside for reasons which I just find perplexing, because this is mainstream social science, and the terms that are used, the one to describe someone being set up to pick a target that's been demonized by a high-profile person is, and then they go out and kill or injure the target person. It's called stochastic terrorism. It means it's unpredictable who will carry it out and who will be the victim. But it's part of a structure starting with the rhetorical demonization of some person or group, a group of people who are identifiable physically or because of the garb or because of their politics. And this is what Trump is doing. Trump is setting up people for harm using the idea of scripted violence, which is what he is using. He's writing a script that says these people are going to destroy America, dot, dot, dot. And somebody goes, well, if they're going to destroy America, we should get them before they get us.
Well, we had the example of the delusional young man from North Carolina who drove up to Georgetown to liberate a group of young kids who were victims of a sex trafficking ring run by Hillary Clinton out of the basement of a pizza parlor. Now, right. if people are listening to this and think, you know, this is science fiction, no, this guy came in with an assault rifle and fired a bunch of shots at the ceiling, mercifully didn't kill anybody. And, of course, there were, needless to say, no victims of sex trafficking. There are, of course, victims of sex trafficking, which we just discussed at the beginning of today's program, with which the Secretary of Labor let off the hook in a despicable story. So in terms of this Coast Guard Lieutenant Christopher Paul Hassan, 49, a former Marine, he worked at the Coast Guard headquarters in Washington. Federal agents found 15 guns, 1,000 rounds of ammunition. He spent about $14,000 on weapons and survival gear and other equipment. And he's been inspired by Breivik, the Norwegian who killed all of those social kids from the Social Democratic Party families in Norway. He was also influenced by another American. But let me just read you the list of people he wanted to kill. Joey, which is apparently Scarborough at MSNBC. Chris Hayes, mostly from MSC. Sen, Blumen Jew, apparently U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Pelosi, we know who that is. Sen Kane, Ari Melba, Schumer, Don Lemon, Gillibrand, that's Kirsten Gillibrand, running for president. Poker Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, running for president. Cortez, meaning Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Booker, another U.S. Senator running for president. Harris, another U.S. Senator running for president. Beto O'Rourke, the representative from Texas. Maxine Waters. And Sheila Jackson, another U.S. Congresswoman. Ilhan Omar, another U.S. Congressman. Chris Cuomo, another journalist on CNN, and DSA, which apparently is the Democratic Socialists of America, and Van Jones, and Podesta. So that's the list. Trump was asked about this on Friday in an Oval Office press opportunity where he said he was going to have a briefing in 2 hours and he'd know more. But he basically, when he was asked, does your rhetoric in any way are you in any way responsible because of your rhetoric for this kind of person being inspired to do these kind of things? And after all, the very people on this the target list are all enemies of the people, as Trump calls them, particularly the people that he's named and singled out for abuse and derision. And he said, oh, no, I'm a nice guy or something ridiculous. So do you think Trump will ever actually face this question again and tell us exactly what he learned in the briefing?
Well, I hope he does face this question repeatedly, but I also hope that American journalists who have been sort of tiptoeing around this issue and refusing to use the social science terminology that exists of scripted violence and stochastic terrorism, that the mainstream media is avoiding making the connection, which has been known since the 1950s, that when you have a high-profile person demonizing over and over and over again a group of people, a type of person, a political affiliation, whatever, that these people are at risk. Because eventually it's possible that someone will say, well, if these people are out to get us, then I'll be a hero. I become the hero saving America on behalf of this president who can't do this himself, and I'll get some guns and I'll go deal with these people and get rid of them. This is the process. And I accuse the mainstream media of refusing to use the terminology of social science, which is well-developed, to describe President Trump, who in fact is inciting terror.
And again, I'm speaking with Chip Bellay, an investigative journalist who studies right-wing movements in the United States, including the religious right, white supremacist, homophobic groups, and paramilitary organizations. He also studies the spread of conspiracy theories in the media and on the internet, and political cults on both the right and the left of the political spectrum. He's the co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, and editor of Eyes Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. Well, the character that that went after the to liberate the kids allegedly held in the basement of the pizza parlor in Georgetown, who were there, captives of Hillary Clinton's sex trafficking ring. As absurd as that is, it actually happened. But where did that absurd information come from? Where does all this absurd information come from? Well, a lot of it comes from Alex Jones, who the president listens to. He thinks he's a great guy. I recall that the National Security Advisor, Mike Flynn, championed that story of the pizza parlor sex ring. And his son also spread that on social media, that ludicrous canard. So aren't these people equally guilty along with Trump?
Well, I believe so. I think that there's a problem, of course, with the First Amendment requiring other people outside of the journalistic environment covering a particular person to say, look, there are these conspiracy theorists. What they claim to be revealing is, in fact, fake news, to borrow a term from our president. It is the fantasies that track all the way back in America to the early settlers who believed that a palpable Satan walked the earth and was always conspiring to snatch away the redemption and resurrection of the true believing Christians. From this developed a whole range of conspiracy theories throughout U.S. history about some evil force, now separated from Satan himself, but an evil force out to destroy America. This becomes cemented in right-wing rhetoric starting way back. And, you look at the claims of the Ku Klux Klan, you look at the claims of some of the people talking about, a vast Jewish conspiracy. You talk about people who talk about a vast Islamic conspiracy or the conspiracy of the feminist movement or the conspiracy of the anti-war movement, all of which are described in right-wing literature in effusive detail with hundreds of books, of which I collected over 75, for the Library of Political Research Associates, that claim there's this vast conspiracy of evil people who are about to take down America, .. Well, if you're a patriot, what do you do?
Chip, just to quote some of Lieutenant Hassan, who was just arrested recently, the Coast Guard lieutenant, who was planning, had a hit list. I read the list of journalists and most of them Democratic candidates for president. in a letter quoted by the prosecutors in his arraignment, he said that he wanted to start a race war and was speculating on the best ways to do it. And quoting him and from his letter, Hassan, "Much blood will have to be spilled to get Whitey off the couch." And then he talked about the standoff in Oregon in 2016 between the Bundys and these other people affiliated with them, protesters protesting the Bureau of Land Management. Quoting Hassan, "Please send me your violence that I may unleash it onto their heads. Guide my hate to make a lasting impression on this world." Now, again, Trump praised the Bundys. So, and he's praised the white supremacist at Charlottesville.
Right.
This is just not isolated, off-the-cuff remarks. This is a pattern that we have a president who praises these people who preach hatred and violence against, you know, their fellow citizens, but also against the government that Trump is the head of.
So you're expecting a kind of a through line of logic, which is absent in this entire realm. These are people who have grabbed onto a particular stereotype of the conspiracy that is said to be at just about ready to happen against the government that they support or the individual politician they support or whatever. What you have here in this particular case is someone who is not just tied up in these conspiracy theories, but a white supremacist, a white nationalist, a person who thinks that part of this conspiracy is an attempt by people of color and Jews and others to take America back from us. Well, who's us? Yeah, obviously, in this case, it's straight white Christian men. So what you have then is this compilation of different motives to defend whiteness, to defend the Constitution as perceived by ultra-conservatives, to defend a whole range of identities which are being threatened by what? By modernity, by the new development of human rights for everyone. Well, these folks don't want human rights for everyone. They want human rights for their local set of friends who are white men who are, you know, the real leaders of America, quote unquote. So this is, in part, the last gasp of this kind of retrograde view of humanity and human rights and, encouraging people to get along together. And it's also a kind of a battle cry of white men who feel emasculated by all of these movements.
Well, you're talking about Trump's base, Chip Lee. I mean, the fact of the matter is that as much as this guy got intercepted, this Coast Guard Lieutenant Hassan, and he wasn't able to kill all of these MSNBC reporters and CNN reporters, along with just about, you know, most of the Democratic candidates running for president against Trump. He also, the fact is that the massacre that took place in the synagogue in Pennsylvania was in part inspired by Trump. There's no two ways about it. The shooter there was absolutely furious at this synagogue because they were taking care of refugees. They had a program dedicated to helping refugees, and he conflated Trump's statements about these invasion of refugees coming up from Central America, these hordes infiltrated by, you know, Middle East terrorists. He said all this stuff. And that's exactly what this guy quoted in his manifesto, that he was, you know, these people had to be shot in the synagogue because they supported refugees, and refugees aren't refugees. They're a bunch of terrorists coming up to kill us. And I mean, I'm literally quoting from what this guy said. Why isn't Trump held responsible?
Well, he should be held responsible by an awoke media, but I'm horrified that almost all of the criticism talking about these social science findings over the last 50, 60, 70 years, I don't know. I don't know where the mainstream media is by tiptoeing around this, because it's really dangerous what's happening now is that these individuals are coming forward to commit acts of terrorism. But at some point, you know, it will create a base that will allow Trump to engage in a kind of tyranny, which is already developing around him, and the way he treats federal agencies and the way he treats law enforcement as essentially an arm of his political will. You know, and there's obviously people like Timothy Snyder at Yale writes about this as being a form of tyranny. I might add that I was actually the day before the synagogue shooting in Pennsylvania, I was in eastern Pennsylvania giving a lecture on heroes know which villains to kill, how coded rhetoric incites scripted violence, which is the speech I'm giving, which is based on an essay I wrote in a book back, you know, years ago. I don't know, I'm at a loss. It's clear what's happening. I feel like it's the people running around prior to the putsch by Hitler saying, don't you know where this is going to end? This can't end well. Things are getting out of hand, and no one pays any attention. I'm at a loss. You know, America, democracy is at risk. We are standing here, as most people in America and most reporters are standing here watching the destruction of the democratic civil society that we all claim, I think, to want, and we're watching it being destroyed by a person who is, you know, deranged and a authoritarian bully.
Well, the one ray of hope, just to end on Chip Belay, is that Michael Cohen will be testifying, Trump's lawyer and fixer. He'll be testifying Wednesday, and he at least will tell the people about what you just said, the derangement, that he basically will say that Trump is a madman. And along with being a squalid sex offender, a criminal, and a traitor, he is also a madman. And that is the challenge to people on the inside have known this for years. People who deal with him know that he's just completely out of control, living in his own narcissistic bubble. That at least will be, I think, an important contribution to trying to get the American people, at least those stuck in the Fox bubble, to understand who this man is.
I certainly hope so. Just anecdotally, my brother went to New York Military Academy with Donald Trump in uniform. My brother played the piccolo in the marching band in uniform, and he described Trump, who he went to high school with, as not very smart, very good at baseball, but essentially a bully and a jerk.
Well, Chip Belay, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Chip Belay, an investigative journalist who studies right-wing movements in the United States, including the religious right, white supremacist, homophobic groups, and paramilitary organizations. He also studies the spread of conspiracy theories in the media and on the Internet and political cults on both the right and the left of the political spectrum. And he's the co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, and editor of Eyes Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the hidden history, which the American people are largely unaware of, but which the Russian people remember only too well. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org And joining us now is James Carl Nelson, the author of three acclaimed histories of the American experience in World War I, including I Will Hold, Five Lieutenants, and The Remains of Company D, A Story of the Great War. He received the 2017 Marine Corps Heritage Foundation's Colonel Joseph Alexander Award for biography, and his latest book just out is The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Carl Nelson.
Thank you very much.
And when you say the forgotten America's forgotten invasion of Russia, of course, it's not forgotten by the Russians.
No, not nearly. I mean, I think the average American has no idea that this occurred 100 years ago, but in the average Russian mind, they've been taught about the Allied invasion. And, Russia was invaded and has been invaded so many times over the years, and this was one, and I think it caused great umbrage that still lasts.
And how does it fit into the broader kind of white Russian versus Bolshevik civil war?
Well, the Bolsheviks were fighting the whites all over the vast country, and the Allies, it was the British, Americans, French, some Poles, even some Italians, were kind of, for a while, just sort of an annoyance. Actually, when the Allies landed in northern Russia in the spring of 1918, Leon Trotsky was happy because there had been rumors that Germans were going to land at Murmansk, which is northwest of Archangel. And they just figured, let's just let the Allies fight the Germans up there, and we'll continue fighting the whites in the rest of the country. As things evolved, the German appearance did not occur, and the Allies, the Americans and British, et cetera, began pushing farther and farther into the interior of Russia from Archangel. And that's when it got onto Trotsky's radar, and he vowed to push them all into the White Sea.
Well, given this investigation that's going on into President Trump's ties to Russia, some have suggested that if it's true that there's some kind of Manchurian candidate scenario going on here, that that would be the greatest intelligence coup since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar and in 1917 and sent him to Russia or to the Soviet Union. Is there a, I mean, we have to put that into context, surely, the fact that just as Stalin made a dirty deal with Hitler and Hitler reneged on it when he invaded Russia, there was a deal made with the Germans and the Bolsheviks, and the entire Eastern Front literally folded, did it not?
The Russians had been holding down the Eastern Front against the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians. With the Bolshevik Revolution in late 1917, of course, the Germans actually began withdrawing troops from the Eastern Front before they signed the Brest-Litovsk Treaty in March of 1918. And once they were able to withdraw from the front, they moved about 80 divisions of soldiers to the Western Front. And these divisions, some of them took part in this huge offensive that it jumped off on March 21st, 1918, which was aimed at splitting the French and British forces and finishing the war before America could get to France in any great numbers. There was only about four divisions in France at that time.
So, essentially, the Eastern Front was empty. So how many troops came in from Britain, France, and you mentioned even Poland and even Italy, and then the 5,000 American polar bears?
I think, if you take the 5,000 polar bears, mainly the 339th U.S. Regiment, I think you could count another 6,000 in the British and the other Allied forces. So at no time, really, were there any greater than, say, 10 or 11,000 Allied soldiers fighting in northern Russia.
And they were fighting against the northern Bolshevik army of more than 45,000 soldiers.
Right, which only grew and grew. But yeah, the Red Army was fairly incompetent at the beginning. It sort of created from scratch after the revolution. That was Leon Trotsky's mission as Minister of War. Through the winter of 1918-1919, he was able to conscript, recruit, bully in the service, Shanghai, numerous troops, so that by the summer of 1919, the Red Army was 600,000 men strong, probably women too. They weren't all devoted to fighting the Allies in the north. They were fighting, like I said, all over the country, trying to defeat the whites. But this, they devoted a significant number of Bolshevik fighters to the north. In one instance, on January 19th, 1919, a single platoon of Company A, the first platoon, 46 men were attacked by 1,700 Bolsheviks at dawn and began a month-long flight that led to the loss of life of 25 of their men.
So let's talk about the... Let me just recap your intro. And again, I'm speaking with James Carl Nelson, the author of three acclaimed histories of the American experience in World War I, including I Will Hold, Five Lieutenants, and The Remains of Company D, A Story of the Great War. He received the 2017 Marine Corps Heritage Foundation's Colonel Joseph Alexander Award for Biography, and his latest book just out is The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia. So let's put ourselves in the shoes of those soldiers. They come from Michigan, so obviously they're used to cold weather, but not as cold as it is up in Archangel, of course. And they're off to fight World War One, and don't they think they're going to France? And
yeah, they're mostly draftees from the 339th Regiment was nicknamed Detroit's Own. Immigrants from Detroit, small town boys, farm boys, they all collected at Camp Custer through 1918. Even up to, some are still coming in, they got their draft notices like in May, and they showed up at Camp Custer just days before the regiment entrained for the coast and headed to England. They got to England and began training there outside of London. And it's funny, there's anecdotally, Harry Mead, a lieutenant with Company A, had been from Valparaiso, Indiana. His family owned a boarding house. And the famed globe-trotting Lawrence of Arabia promoter, Lowell Thomas, had gone to Valparaiso and had actually stayed with the family. And Harry and Lowell crossed paths in London on a street one day when Harry was off on leave. And Harry told him, hey, we're about ready to go to France. And Lowell was like, well, that's not what I hear. I hear you're going to Russia. So that was the first inkling. The second inkling was when the famed Antarctic explorer Ernest Shackleton showed up and started giving lectures on how to survive in Arctic conditions. And that pretty much nailed it. And to their, I don't know what the word is, dismay, I guess, they found out that they were not headed for France to join the American Expeditionary Force there, but to far north Russia, a very unknown place to the average American.
But did Woodrow Wilson share the fact that he was ordering these troops from Michigan to fight in Russia? Was that widely shared with the American public?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm not sure how many people in the average across the country would have known about this. He had initially opposed being involved in the intervention. The Allies had pled with him and pled with him through the spring of 1918 and into the summer, and finally in mid-July, he sat down and wrote this tortured aide-de-memoir and said, here's why we're not going to send troops, and then he finally wound up saying, well, here's why we are going to send troops. I don't know if that was widely known. I don't believe it was. You know, it was a military mission, you know, I don't think it was. And, you know, the men of the 339th Regiment didn't hear of it until probably mid to two-thirds of the way through August. And before they knew it, they were heading across England and boarding transports for Archangel.
So what was the strategy, though, with the French and the British and the reluctant Americans, as you've just described, Wilson? What were they trying to do? Was this punitive? What was the broader strategy here?
Well, yeah, the whole idea was with the Western Front in peril, such as it was in the early summer of 1918, the whole idea was to alleviate the pressure the Germans were putting on the Western Front by trying to recreate the Eastern Front back in East Prussia, Poland, these kind of places. And so they were going to go through this intervention, land, hopefully incite the local populace to help them. And then they're also going to reach out to this body of 40,000 to 80,000 Czech troops who had been prisoners of war in Russia, who the Bolsheviks were allowing to leave through Vladivostok, far to the west, far to the east, I should say, and then turn that whole bunch around, and they were all going to converge on the Eastern Front. But in the British mind, there was a larger design of actually undoing the communist revolution. So when the Americans arrived, they were immediately pushed southeast towards up the Dvina River toward Kotlas, about 300 miles away, down the railroad line towards Vologda, about 400 miles away. And the idea, as crazy it may sound now, was that they were going to basically build this huge czarist force and wind up undoing the revolution and taking Moscow. And this was supposed to happen all by, like, November of 1918. They gave them 2 months to do this, and they fell far, far short.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, tell us about what happened in 1929 when some of the veterans of the polar bear incursion, I guess, into Russia in 1918,
yeah.
1919. They went back to Russia.
Sorry, okay.
To get the, they went back to Russia to retrieve the bodies of 86 fallen polar bears from the frozen wastes of Archangel.
Right. The Americans were finally started sailing out of Archangel in June of 1919. And when they got back to the United States, they formed the Polar Bear Association. And they had reunions, just kept the memory of their lives, their sacrifices alive. And, you know, but the thought was, what about the boys who are still over there? They were managed to bring, I think, 112 bodies of men who had died in Russia back with them initially. But they got the idea to go back and get as many of the other ones that they could, you know, leave no man behind. And so they started raising funds. They got some funds from the Michigan, state of Michigan, other places, and went to Europe, and after some negotiations, were allowed to enter Russia and scattered to these various fronts that they had fought over. It was really a 400-mile front. And, yeah, like you said, we're able to locate and disinter 86 bodies. And about half of those bodies, they were all brought home. Some were claimed by relatives in various spots for private burial, but about half of them wound up being laid out around the Polar Bear Monument.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today and for sharing this extraordinary story in your new book, James Nelson, The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.